This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Interest rates, tax policy, and a little bit of Coca-Cola on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Dallas, Texas today from the studios of KERA, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you along, everybody. How about this? How about we start with a story not about the election or politics or transitions or any of that jazz, but instead about interest rates. And interestingly, one in which the name Janet Yellen does not appear at all. How about that? The number two guy at the Fed, Vice Chair Stanley Fischer, gave a speech today in which he basically said the Fed has come to the conclusion the economy's got a new normal vis-a-vis interest rates, and that new normal is well below the conventional wisdom of even a year ago, when the thinking was the rates might go up to as much as 4.5%. Those days, he said, are gone. So the question now for us is, what does this new normal about interest rates tell us about the new normal of the economy? Marketplace's Sabri Benishor gets us going.
Higher interest rates are like a brake on the economy. And it used to be, for decades, we thought a healthy level of braking for a normal, functioning economy was to have the Fed aim for interest rates of 4.5%. That belief has changed. The level now looks lower, maybe around 2.9%. If our economy is a car, it's just not speeding along, so it doesn't need much braking.
The slow growth type of economy that we've experienced over the last several years is likely to be normal going forward.
Brian Railing is with the Wells Fargo Investment Institute. There are a lot of factors behind this.
Lower productivity is number one.
Productivity growth, new technology, new inventions, it drives GDP growth, and it's a fraction of what it used to be. Another issue, we're getting older as a country.
That means people are moving out of the workforce into retirement.
Lower labor force growth, again, lower GDP growth, less need for higher interest rates. Now, for the Fed, this new world of low interest rates is a bit of a problem.
That does reduce the Fed's maneuvering, you know, in case we run into a recession.
Richard Silla is professor emeritus of economics at NYU Stern School. Lowering interest rates in an economy can be like pushing on the gas pedal. But if the pedal's already down, there's not much more you can do. Joseph Gagnon is with the Peterson Institute. He says some economists have other concerns about a slow-growth, low-interest-rate world.
We're going to find recessions more common and longer-lasting.
Another school of thought says, no, it's okay. We'll just have to live with slower growth, and that'll be that. Either way, it's the new normal. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishor for Marketplace.
Republicans in general seem to be pretty happy right now. Tax nerd Republicans, they can't even stand it. For a decade or more, the GOP has been dreaming about comprehensive tax reform, both as a way to simplify the tax code and to cut taxes overall. Now, it might actually happen. So Marketplace's Mark Garrison tells us what the plan might be.
For conservative tax cutters, Election Day was a surprise in a fantastic way.
We've shifted from nothing's going to happen in the next 4 years to the sky's the limit.
Grover Norquist is influential in Washington as president of Americans for Tax Reform. He's known for taking such a hard line on cutting taxes, he's sometimes fought with his own party. There are some differences between tax plans from President-elect Trump and congressional Republicans, but nothing Norquist worries about.
It's very exciting to have a Republican House, Senate, and president who are on the same page on tax reform. So this could move a lot more rapidly than previous tax cuts.
That means sharpening big axes to cut rates for all kinds of people and also corporations. Veronique DeRogier is senior fellow at the Mercatus Center.
We can expect serious lowering of the corporate income tax rate, which right now stands at the federal level of 35%, down to 20% or 15%.
As for the taxes people pay, Republicans have a chance to achieve what they've been dreaming about for years, lower rates across fewer tax brackets. Alex Brill is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute.
They want to dramatically simplify the tax code, and then fewer exemptions and deductions are allowed as well.
Keep in mind, the Republican edge in the Senate is slight, meaning Democrats can filibuster, but Republicans have an imperfect way around that called reconciliation, which they used to pass the Bush tax cuts. Another thing to watch is the earned income tax credit, which helps many low-income families in the past and has been a rare piece of common ground for Republicans and Democrats, but that could change. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
This is going to sound terrible, but the fact of the matter is that identity theft is a business opportunity, big business, to judge by today's mergers and acquisitions news. The cybersecurity giant Symantec is buying LifeLock. That's an ID protection company for $2.3 billion. Among other things, Symantec makes antivirus software, which has traditionally been bundled with PCs, which, as we all know, is a market on the wane. So the company has had to look elsewhere for growth. Marketplace's Adam Allington has more.
Adding LifeLock to Symantec's stable allows the company to say that it can now provide a comprehensive cybersecurity defense, offering both antivirus and identity protection.
It is truly a 1+1=3 for the consumer.
Greg Clark is the CEO of Symantec. According to the company, identity theft affects about 1/3 of North Americans. That's a lot of would-be customers, and they're willing to pay more to protect their personal data than they would for regular old antiviral software.
Consumers have a propensity to pay 2 to 3 times more for identity protection right now. So it's highly valued in the mindset of a consumer.
LifeLock is probably best known for its advertising. Take this bank robbery ad, which compares a hapless security guard to the current state of identity theft software.
Hey, do something.
Oh, I'm not a security guard. I'm a security monitor. I only notify people if there's a robbery. There's a robbery.
Beyond the ad, cybersecurity reporter Brian Krebs says LifeLock can't guarantee protection, and their biggest feature is still helping people clean up the hack after it's already happened. He also points out that many Americans are getting ID theft protection services for free from companies who've already lost their data to hackers. Whether that translates into future growth is an open question.
So it's not clear to me, you know, how many customers they retain going from free to paid.
Krebs says one of the best things consumers can do to guard against cyber attacks is actually basic stuff like regularly changing passwords. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, record highs for all my friends. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here are three words upon which the American presidential election of 2016 basically turned. White working class. We heard that label or variations on it a ton during the campaign, mostly in the context of how fed up some members of that group are with Washington and with the economy and with, to be honest, the media. So on the better than even chance that we're going to be hearing more about white working class Americans in the next 4 or more years, we asked Marketplace's Rima Kreis to find out exactly who they are.
Before I let the experts take over, here are some non-experts and their take on white working class.
I just think of people like myself, people that do physical labor.
Plumbers, electricians, builders, things like that.
I really used to be working class poor, is what we used to say, and I don't know if that was something that was deemed derogatory, but maybe this is exactly the same thing.
I don't know. I personally don't think about that stuff. I just got to get up and turn screws.
That was Macon Hatton from Texas, Robert Miles from Oklahoma, Kara Cruz from D.C., and Luther Kilmer, also from Texas. A lot of people we talk to struggle to describe working class, and that may be because
there is no correct definition.
Okay, we're with the experts now. Rui Teixeira has written several books about the working class in elections. He says historically, working class meant white men in blue-collar jobs, manufacturing, construction. But today, a lot of those jobs have been replaced by low-level service positions. And those men have been joined by a growing number of women, African Americans, Latinos. Teixeira says you could define this group by data on occupation or income, but
occupation, too expensive and hard to ask. Income, you know, you had to set an arbitrary cutoff, and those categories change over time because of inflation. So what we're left with is, you know, this college-non-college distinction.
A distinction that became a major discussion point in the election. Donald Trump won white voters without college degrees by 39 points, according to exit polls.
Today, the American working class is going to strike back, finally.
But the education divide has also fueled stereotypes.
They are depicted as ignorant. They are depicted as too lazy to get a college education.
Like Homer Simpson, says Joan Williams. She directs the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California Hastings College of Law. She says one of the few positive depictions of blue-collar work is on the show Dirty Jobs.
Hard-working men and women who earn an honest living doing the kinds of jobs that make civilized life possible for the rest of us.
Williams says you also can't generalize about working class earnings. They can range from as little as $30,000 a year to $60,000. That's why she says it's more useful to define this class culturally rather than economically.
The classic white working class guy had a dad who had a good blue-collar job with which he supported the family, but today's working class men can't get anywhere near those kinds of jobs.
She says many see success differently, too. They tend to admire the rich, but resent professionals.
From a blue-collar standpoint, professionals just spend their whole time in office politics and sucking up to each other.
From a blue-collar standpoint, she says it's better to have your own business. That's also the case for Macon Hatton, who we heard from earlier. He works at a coffee shop in Dallas.
A lot of people dream to be on the other side of the check, but it's hard for us, I would say even myself, to mentally get motivated because our mind gets so consumed with what we're doing.
In the meantime, there's widespread economic frustration. Take 52-year-old Danny Leidecker from Kannapolis, North Carolina. He used to work in a textile mill. Now many of those mills are gone.
I like to see American people making their products instead of sending them overseas.
Like so many in the working class, Leidecker is betting on Republicans and Trump for a brighter economic future, one that sometimes looks a lot like a return to the past. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
You know the saying, there's an app for that? Popular a couple of years ago, but not now so much because, of course, there's an app for that. Well, how about books? Novels, to be precise. And I don't mean e-books or any of that. Wally Lem is a New York Times best-selling author. He's also leading the way into new digital territory by publishing his latest book. It's called I'll Take You There, in an app produced by the company Metabook. Yes, you get the written text, of course, but also a full cast, audio dramatization, an original soundtrack, short films, a photo gallery as well, lots of stuff. Wally Lem, it's good to talk to you.
Hey, good to speak with you too, Kai.
I will tell you, I messed around with it a little bit last night at home on an iPad, and it was quite the experience. I do wonder, though, what it was that made you as an author be interested in writing a book for this format.
I think in terms of, you know, my technical ability and so forth, I'm about a day and a half's drive away from the cutting edge. However, this just dazzled me when I saw the prototype. The Metabook guys showed me something that they had made from the John Berendt book.
Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil.
Yeah. And I was just I was amazed at what you can do when you read a story. And so I didn't really shape the story to the Metabook design.
Yeah.
You know, I was encouraged to write the story and then, you know, they would play with it creatively, you know, once I had that down.
You know what it reminded me a lot of as I was messing around with this app last night? Because it's an app, right? I mean, it's a book inside an app, basically.
An enhanced ebook, yeah.
Enhanced ebook, that's good. What it reminded me of was back when DVDs started to come with all those extras, right? Like the behind-the-scenes interviews and the cutting room floor scenes and all that jazz. And that never really caught on. And I wonder if you worry about the same fate for this.
You know, I don't, because I look at the way that my millennial-aged kids consume media. You know, when they come home for Christmas, they're in their early 30s now, but when they come home for Christmas or whatever, They're watching ESPN. They're on their iPod, and they're typing electronically or reading something on a tablet. So a lot of people talk about millennials having a shorter attention span. I think it's just a different way to consume.
But don't you, as an author, right, as the guy who sweats and bleeds and gets these words on a page, right? Don't you want people to just sit down with the piece of paper and the actual paper book and be in your words?
Well, that's the way I will read, whether it's electronically or turning pages. But I look at my wife. We're the same age, and she reads electronically, and she loves to take breaks between chapters and, look up something on Wikipedia or look at a word that she doesn't know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, same here. Talk to me for a second about the book itself. It's called I'll Take You There. What prompted you to write it? It's about a woman who was big in silent films.
Yeah, I had a little novel that was published back in 2007. It's called Wishin' and Hopin'. And it was made into a movie, and the premiere of the movie was at a wonderful old vaudeville theater in New London, Connecticut. It's called the Guard Theater. And so while I was down there talking to the managers, they mentioned just sort of casually that there have been ghost sightings at this theater. So I thought, well, that was interesting. I started doing research, and I found the name Lois Weber. Mm-hmm. She was a silent film director. I'm thinking to myself, silent film director who's a woman?
Yeah.
Wow. She was just a fascination to me. She was a mover and shaker back in the days of D.W. Griffith, but of course she's sort of fallen by the wayside. So I made her a ghost who's haunting the Guard Theater, and, I put her center stage.
The new book from Wally Lamb, and it is now out in something called Meta Book, is a novel called I'll Take You There. Wally, thanks very much for your time.
Hey, thanks. I really enjoyed this. Appreciate it.
Coming up.
They turned the practice of product placement into an art rather than just sort of an incidental.
What do you think? Who gets the blame or the credit, depending on your point of view? But first, let's do the numbers. More records today. The Dow Industrial's up 88 points, about 0.4%, finished at 18,956. The NASDAQ up 47 points, 0.9%, 53.68. The S&P 500 added 16.7%, 21.98. Again, there is talk that OPEC is going to limit oil production, so again, beaten down energy stocks rally. Among independents, Northern Oil and Gas up 10.8% today, however, keep in mind that is just 20 cents a share. Among the bigs, Marathon Petroleum up 9%. Chevron 0.9% higher today. CF Industries, it makes nitrogen fertilizer. It grew 3%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note thus down 2.31%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Coming up this season on Codebreaker.
If we want to survive, we need to change our bodies.
I never in my wildest dreams when I was teaching her how to do this thought that she would actually have to do it.
We are back with a second season and a new question. Can it save us? We're asking this question of a different kind of technology every week. Subscribe now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen, decode, and decide.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out Public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. A couple of big retailers, Target and Best Buy, among them, reported better than expected third quarter earnings last week. Back to school was really good for them, and hopes are high for the holiday shopping season that starts this week with Black Friday, if you can believe that. The National Retail Federation predicts a 3.6% increase in sales this holiday season over last, with this caveat: the economic unknowns of the incoming Trump administration and what consumers might make of it. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra visited a pop-up holiday market in New York City to get a sense of what's happening on the ground.
The day after the election, when C.J. Thomason looked around Manhattan, he saw people staring into space, crying on the subway.
You know, it definitely felt like a funeral home.
Thomason is sitting at a holiday market in New York's Bryant Park at the kiosk for his custom-made eyewear company, Sire's Crown. Thomason's a manufacturer, and he thinks President-elect Donald Trump's policies might help him. But since the election, he's also started to worry that some of his customers will be too distraught to shop this year.
I became immediately aware that, this is going to have an economic hit.
Paula Delgado says that's already happened at her handcrafted jewelry store, Muhus.
I have seen a dip.
Nearby, people are ice skating, eating popcorn, admiring the holiday lights. But immediately after the election, sales at Muhus dropped to a quarter of what they were before the vote. Delgado says, yeah, maybe this will blow over and people will start shopping again. Or
they might also just hold on to their money.
There's a reason to think things will go back to normal. Lynn Franco, director of economic indicators at the Conference Board, says what really determines the strength of holiday season sales is the health of the economy.
We've seen positive gains, you know, in employment, in wages. I think consumers are on more solid footing today than they were a year ago. So I think we're in pretty good shape heading into the holidays.
Not all shoppers are tying their holiday spending choices to the election. Ming Kong and his friend Jeff Musanti say the election has nothing to do with their shopping plans.
It's not a big deal to us.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine it being that big of a deal to other people. You know, Trump's president, okay.
I'm still going to have Christmas.
Yeah.
And some folks might even spend more. Kate Weglars, who stopped by the holiday market with her husband and mother-in-law, puts it this way.
You know, sometimes when you're upset about something, you shop. So if anything, I think it'll cause me to shop more.
Two words: retail therapy. In New York, I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
There you are, minding your own business, watching a movie or a TV show, and some totally gratuitous product placement comes on. Maybe a car, or a computer, or a soda brand, or something. In a point of fact, while product placement has been around for a very long time, big soda is at the modern root of it all. Kevin Lincoln is a senior editor at Vulture. His story on the topic at hand is titled, "You Can Blame Soda Brands for the Rise in Product Placement in Entertainment." Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Coca-Cola basically is where we go to find the genesis of product placement?
Yeah, you know, Coke was sort of the major first adopter of the practice of product placement. I mean, they turned the practice of product placement into an art rather than just sort of an incidental opportunity.
And in fact, I mean, just to get this out there, they eventually buy a movie studio, for crying out loud.
Right. So they buy Columbia Pictures for $750 million, which at the time, studios had been a part of companies with diverse interests like Gulf and Western. But Coke buying Columbia was a big change because this was a soft drink company buying a movie studio, just wholesale.
Right. Do we then see Coke products more in Columbia movies? And they made some big films, too.
Right. They did. So when Coke bought Columbia, they had just gotten a new head honcho, and Coke hadn't been doing that well.
Right.
So he bought Columbia also right before the launch of Diet Coke. So it was became sort of a symbolic start to a new and very lucrative era for Coke.
There is also actually a Pepsi sort of slapback, if you will, that comes out of this whole Coke thing, right? And it goes to Back to the Future.
Right, exactly. So when you have Coke purchasing the studio, all of a sudden it's like doubling down on their sort of enormous influence. And Pepsi basically thinks like, well, it's either now or never in terms of trying to compete. And I think through knowing the producers on Back to the Future 1, they managed to get a pretty prominent Pepsi placement in Back to the Future 1. And so the idea then that came to them that in Back to the Future 2, they could go a step farther and create an entirely new Pepsi product for the movie.
That exists only in that universe,
only
right?
Isn't that the deal?
Yeah, Pepsi
Perfect.
Right.
But, you know, the interesting thing about that is Pepsi Perfect isn't just product placement. You know, it's a step up where the product becomes a part of the narrative.
The other one you pull out is Reese's spending $1 million to get those little Reese's pieces that E.T. leaves in the woods. Or maybe it's Henry, I don't even know. Leaves in the woods in E.T.
Right, and the most interesting thing about that is that Spielberg had wanted M&Ms.
Oh, is that right?
Right.
Oh, that's
so Spielberg
great.
Wanted M&Ms, and they were not interested. And so Reese's Pieces said, all right, well, we'll do that. And Reese's Pieces was not at that time a particularly well-known product. And so they took advantage of it, and it was a huge boon for the product. And that $1 million they spent is also kind of a unique deal because they didn't pay it directly to the makers of E.T. They spent it on advertising for the movie.
Right. Does it work? I mean, if I, you know, I love Reese's Pieces, but that's not what made me love Reese's Pieces, seeing E.T. in the woods, for crying out loud.
Right. It does actually work, which is the most interesting thing about it. You look at that heyday of product placement in the 80s. Kind of my favorite example are the Tom Cruise Ray-Ban partnership, because you look at Top Gun and you look at Risky Business. Wayfarers and aviators become a part of the image of cool that is projected by Cruise in Risky Business and in Top Gun. And it boosted Ray-Ban's sales considerably. I believe it actually more or less saved Wayfarers as a brand. But yeah, it works when it's done in a way that is both subtle but unmistakable.
Kevin Lincoln writes on movies for Vulture and New York Magazine. Kevin, thanks for coming in.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Final note on the way out today, possibly of interest to those of you flying hither and yon this week. Spotted on the website Eater.com, a reminder of what can and cannot go through airport security. Frozen turkey is fine, but if any of the ice or ice packs that it is packed in start to melt, well, then it's liquid. The TSA says 3.4 ounces on that one. Mashed potatoes and cranberry sauce, also, sadly, liquids or gels, according to TSA, 3.4 ounces there as well. Ziploc bag, the whole deal. Pity, huh? All right, we got to go. The Dow up 88 points today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 47 points, 0.9%. The S&P 500 up 16.7 tenths%. Records all over the place. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Gurova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. Thanks today to the staff here at KERA in Dallas, Texas. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back in Los Angeles tomorrow. Everybody all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.